Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. Thank you for joining me for today's SMIE Consulting Midweek Roundup. I'm your host, Marty Bennett, and today on the Roundup for January 6, 2021, we welcome you to the first Roundup of the new year. And Happy New Year to all of you who have enjoyed a nice, hopefully relaxing Christmas and holiday break. Hopefully you've recharged your batteries and are ready to go in the new year. Looking forward to a different year than we had, a much better year, a brighter year than we had in 2020. Certainly couldn't get much worse, but in terms of international ed news, we're going to keep on in 2021, updating you with the latest and greatest news that we've found from around the globe related to international education and how it might impact what you do in your day-to-day jobs in international education. As always, we take the time on Wednesday afternoon to look at three questions that we've seen popping up in themes throughout some news stories from other international educators about what's happening in our field. And what we look forward to today is an opportunity to take a broader scope of what's happening in the field and looking at two of our key markets in the United States. As well as a trend that has become rather the norm, and especially in this a pandemic plague season we're in, kind of a new norm in terms of what we're looking forward to as a part of the international education structure that we all enjoy and feel is such a dynamic field to begin with. As we do each week, we start with our SMIE newsletter that comes out on Mondays, and we look at we publish stories on both social media and international ed news, and then we take three of the stories from those, our themes from those news items, and put those together for the roundup on Wednesdays. If you're not already subscribed to the newsletter, I'm dropping the link to the most recent edition of all the SMIE news fit to share. That's the name of our newsletter. You can hit the subscribe now button, and then you'll get to that coming to your inboxes Monday mornings. For those who have been watching faithfully here on Facebook, either live or on repeat, watching on our YouTube channel on demand, or making our podcast of the Roundup, the audio version of this, available and downloading that each week, we crossed a milestone over the last few days. We've finally reached 1,000 downloads of the Midweek Roundup. So thank you to all the loyal listeners out there who've made the Roundup part of their listening journey each week. And happy to be coming to you again today. So let's get right to the first question. Will there be a rebound of Indian student interest in the United States in this coming year? And the early indicators are yes. Certainly last fall, we saw huge drop-offs from every major source country sending students to the United States just because of the pandemic, for consulates and embassies not being closed. We saw 98% fewer visas issued in China, 80% fewer visas issued in India on a year-to-year basis, fiscal year basis. So certainly there was only room to grow. So is there going to be a rebound? Yes. Is it going to be pent-up interest? Yes. So there's good indicators early on that the U.S. should see a rebounding of interest from India. There's been a couple articles over the last couple of weeks that have pointed to that are from sources in India. And we first show you an article from Telangana Today. That's in the Andhra Pradesh, Telangana region of India, where more student visas are issued at the Hyderabad consulate in a normal year than anywhere else in the country, one of the most heavily populated regions for outbound student interest. The title of this article, More Indian Students Applying for Fall Semester, they're not really relying on any hard data here. I don't think that exists just yet, but what they are seeing is an increase in interest and inquiries at agencies through Education USA, through events that have been going on, attendance levels that those have seem to have popped up. And it's also pointing to alternative testing as a reason why there's increased interest now in the U.S. again, pointing to Duolingo as one of the new English language tests that students can take, much more flexible version, home can be done at home. And that's allowing interest to resume, and certainly As we know with Indian student interest, there's always high attention paid to what's happening with H-1Bs and OPT. And with the Biden administration coming in, we've already talked about that in the past few weeks on the difference that's going to make in certain markets where practical training and work experience is at the top of the list of students that are looking at the United States. So certainly India is number one on that list in terms of where that resonates best in the world for as a driver to the United States in terms of OPT and STEM OPT and H-1B. So with an incoming administration, they'll be more friendly toward H-1B and OPT concerns and international things in general. There's certainly a lot to look forward to with regard to that. So we see a lot of interest. Obviously, STEM is going to be very important in India. Another article that also also in India that talks about the real issues. This is Times of India that says a surge in foreign students is likely to in U.S. universities. And that's, again, not based on any real data that's out there, but certainly a lot of interest from students in India and from U.S. institutions that have been active in India. It's a shorter article, but does at least paint that picture that there is light at the end of the tunnel for those that have India on their recruitment radar. Certainly, in-country recruitment isn't necessarily going to be possible anytime soon. Even with the rollout of vaccines, that is going to be a considerable time before travel and even host institutions that might have people coming into their venues. That will be certainly not anytime, I would say, until maybe late in 2021 or early 2022 before we see any significant travel, recruitment travel possible. So the virtual piece is still going to be a very important part of that. Agents or in-country presence that institutions have is going to be, for the time being, going to be the way to get direct contact or indirect contact with students in person. And that is something that a lot of institutions are having to grapple with that have been used to traditional travel. And India certainly was a very well-traveled path for recruiters that are looking to get at international student interest in that country. So we'll see where that goes, but it's certainly the light is reappearing in India in terms of openness to the United States, which I don't think ever went away, but certainly the pandemic has had a negative impact on it, as it has many facets of our lives. So India is certainly one where pent-up demand is going to be there to explore the United States again. Obviously, in the last couple of years, 3 years, Canada's interest in India as a source market has increased dramatically. Indians have been very highly attracted to the Canadian system of immigration and work and pathways to citizenship from student and work positions. So there's a lot. The playing field is much more competitive and much broader now in India for the interests of Indian students, but certainly quality-wise and certainly length of work visa-wise, for STEM students in particular, you're not going to get better than what students can have in the United States. So that's certainly positive things in our favor in the United States, where India should rebound well, and I'm certainly going to put myself firmly in the positive category here for where student interest should be going from that country in the next few months as we look to a fall 2021 term for our next major intake of students in not quite a normal, but certainly a different scope, a different playing field than we've had this for the last few months. Now, so let's shift gears and look at China and the question of how is China doing with international education these days. Now, China, as we know, has for many years been the number one source for international students in the top 15 to 17 destinations. In over half of those countries, China is the number one source of students. There one recent figure I've seen between 2016 and 2019, this is in Xinhua Net News. Obviously, Xinhua is the mouthpiece for the Chinese Communist Party, and they have put out their latest data shows that from 2016 to 2019, 2.5 million students Chinese students studied abroad outside of China, and that 80% of those students have returned to China after completing their studies. So that certainly shows a lot in terms of where Chinese student interest lies, and they are still or had been going out in record numbers. And that there also have been, much like we have in the U.S., we receive far more international students than we send U.S. students on study abroad, almost 3-1. And China has a similar issue here, but they have seen incredible growth in the number of international students coming to China for study, for periods of study. Now, back 3-4 years ago, the greater majority of those students that were going to China for a portion of their higher education were doing so for short-term, 6 months or less, or summer programs, or maybe intensive language programs. They weren't generally going in the whole for degree studies. I think at one point in 2018, it was maybe 30% were actually of the international students in China were studying at the degree level. Now, what we've seen, obviously, since then is China, as part of their Belt and Road Initiative, has dramatically expanded their educational initiatives beyond the initial transportation and infrastructure needs that they typically have gone into countries to invest in. Education has become a much more important part of that as part of their soft power initiatives. We've talked about that at length here on the Roundup. But what this has led to is, up until the pandemic hit, China had moved into third and maybe even second place in terms of the most popular destinations for international students. So in large part due to the scholarships that were in place, the low cost of living at many of the institutions, the support that they would get on campus, that was certainly a rising tide for international students looking at China. The pandemic's changed that, frankly. What has happened, we all know that we won't really know the true story of how bad the pandemic was or did get in China, but what we know from people who are on the ground there is that life is very different. The number of checkpoints and screenings you go through each day, if you're just going to work, there may be 4, 5, or 6 different checks, temperature checks, or digital ID, health ID checks through a government or app, various apps that exist there that track movements. Much more certainly mandatory contact tracing that would track people's movements so that people could be identified as to who they have interacted with through mobile devices and such. So all of that has changed the day-to-day life, and life is much more monitored, much stricter, more strictly tracked in country. On the university campuses, certainly no exceptions to that. International students report that they are under, sometimes aren't able to leave campus on their own, go into the cities in which they are living. That their movements are much more restricted. They are now have cameras inside the residence halls, inside bathrooms and other areas that certainly give pause to obviously those from a Western background that are used to those much more free or open campus environment. Certainly not to say that U.S. campuses haven't been much more concerned with student movements as well, obviously tracking and contact tracing and all of those things and off-campus parties and all of that hinders U.S. Containment of the virus here, but regular testing and all of the things that have gone into play during the pandemic. If we think what we have in the U.S. has been restrictive on campus for those that have fairly well-defined plans, in China, multiply that by 10. And that has led to a lot of concern amongst international students and a point to South China Morning Post article. And South China Morning Post is typically not always that critical of the national government in China. But their headline is Coronavirus Visa Uncertainty Turns Foreign Students Against China. Thousands of young people are waiting to hear if they will be allowed back into the country to continue their studies. Much like students that have had left or were looking to go to New Zealand or Australia, they've basically been shut out of returning to the country because of travel restrictions in those countries. China is certainly no exception and probably a bit more severe of restrictions apply there. than anywhere else. But the bottom line is international students cannot get into China right now and haven't been since March, since even February. So there's a lot of concern, and the delays and the lack of information, the lack of any timetables are causing significant concern amongst international students. And with the secondary tag on this article, many are giving up and growing angry as Beijing's soft power diplomacy in education suffers. So certainly it's not a bright day for China and when it comes to international education in their nation, certainly their attempts to grow their international student populations, they have been dented reputationally. There's probably been damage done, much like it has in the United States, because of our lack of control of coronavirus. They're probably seen in some circles as overly controlling the virus. So there's definitely both ends of the spectrum at play here, and damage has been done on both sides. But in China in particular, as we look at what's happened there, there's certainly going to be some repercussions down the road and some soured interest in studying there. And we've seen that similarly with Australia and New Zealand, that students don't want to wait that long. That IDP Connect data that we've shared in the past has reflected that students want in-person study, even if it means going through quarantine and going through restrictions. They're willing to put up with that if it means they can have education face-to-face, because that's their whole reason for wanting to study abroad, is to have that experience, that in-person experience, that on-campus experience. And right now, that's not possible in three of the six major destination markets. That is just physically not possible. So when we look at what China is facing right now, there's the PR impact of coronavirus. There's the border restrictions that are preventing students from returning. There's the reputational damage based on how they're handling certain situations with students that didn't leave and did decide to stay. That we'll see where that goes, but I think there's certainly some concern in China that the worst is not over for them, and they will be experiencing the effects of what they've done with coronavirus and their response to it for some time to come. So that's what we have for question two. Our final question today is probably one of the ones that 10 years ago was starting to come onto the radar of a lot of institutions in the United States. But since over the last year or so, certainly in the last 9 months of the pandemic, the need for these types of programs has just accelerated dramatically. And what we're talking about here are pathways. Now, there are a lot of different versions of what pathways look like and where they're hosted, how they're tied to the individual institutions, all of these different things, if it's English, if it's academic, if it's both. So when we talk about pathways here, we're talking in the broader scope, not just a third party that's coming to your campus to build a building or to just have do English language training for prospective students to get into your programs, to do conditional admits, all of that. Foundation years for a lot of the European style, like British and Australian, New Zealand education systems that have foundation programs that they'll take students from to begin their studies. These pathways exist on a lot of different levels. And so it's not just the providers that we're talking about here. Some are homegrown, some are through third parties that work with, have facilities in certain countries that are for multiple institutions. So there's a lot of different variations of what we're talking about here. But the question is, are pathways an essential part of international recruitment? And it's been prompted by a couple of articles in the Pi News over the last month or so that have come from folks who work at Study Group, one of the pathway providers. And the question in the most recent article that they authored is, why pathway programs are an important part of international higher education. And it talks about tapping into the dream of studying for students abroad, that are looking to study abroad as part of their higher education dreams of expanding their horizons, of meeting students from all over around the world, developing a worldwide network, the appeal of a degree from a prestigious institution. All of that's part of the want and desire to study abroad. Now, studying in another country is almost becoming, in some places, a rite of passage and an expectation. to distinguish yourself in the long run in your degree field and your career, to help broaden the scope of possibilities for where what you can do with a degree in careers and where you can work after you're done. For undergraduates or postgraduates that are looking to study overseas, sometimes there's an in-between step before that can become a reality. And these pathways have existed in Australia for over 20 years, and for 15 years or so in the UK, and in the last 10 or so years, they've certainly grown in popularity in the United States, as the number of pathway providers has certainly grown. Now, what we've seen, obviously, in the U.S., there's some have had greater success than others. There's been a lot of up and downs, and some providers have gone all in markets and have gotten 20 partners in the U.S. or more. Some have kind of been building slowly and growing. So there's been a lot of different ways third-party providers have operated here in the U.S., but the variations on the themes in terms of what those look like certainly are dramatically different. No matter where you look in the world. And the universities have a very significant role to play in who they partner with when it comes to a pathway if they're not doing it on their own. And obviously, you need to have a fairly significant investment from your institution if you're going to put together a pathway that is homegrown and that has English and academic. Maybe it's probably the easier piece of the puzzle is if it is homegrown, certainly integration into a university system for English, for academics, is going to be a much smoother process than necessarily when you're bringing in an outside party to facilitate something. Now, the support that's necessary on campus, don't need to go into that right now, but we're really talking here about what the pathway providers are, what the pathway programs provide, whether it's what's called a backdoor into an institution or an intermediate step where students can get their academics up and or their English proficiency up to a level that's needed to enter the education system in a much more smoother process, much more streamlined process. So there's still apprehension out there in the marketplace, if particularly from institutions that haven't gone down the path yet to explore it. And what I think about this article that I posted the link to for the Pi News, from the Pi News, from the study group folks, is obviously it's a little bit self-serving in terms of the article itself, but because it's coming from a study group person. But what it does show is that what pathway programs do provide is opportunity to support a very diverse student cohort on campus. Because of the intentions of the program to kind of give a microcosm of what the student experience is, a transition period for those students to get adjusted to the living environment, then grow in their English confidence, English language confidence, and academic ability to handle the transition completely to full-time study. So what it does do, frankly, is it opens doors to a wider set of students that would be academically fine choices for your institution, but need their English abilities improved a bit, or academically they're coming from a very different system, but need time to get the skill set necessary to handle the particularly a postgraduate course load and the research intensive methods involved. So there's a lot of benefits that these pathway programs can provide and really frankly need to be, before pandemic happened, need to be a part of the conversation in terms of what an institutional strategy might look like on the broader scope of things. Now, what the pandemic has forced is opportunities for institutions to, and you saw pieces of this develop, and I say the definition of pathway is a fairly broad one, but what we've seen develop in the course of the last 9 months is institutions who in the spring realize, okay, these students aren't going to be able to get here, admitted international students aren't going to be able to get here for the fall, we need to put something together for them, whether that is a full-time course load, coursework that can be taught online for a semester or for a year, And that's certainly something that we haven't seen. We've seen a few few institutions go down this path and have done so successfully. I'm going to put a link to a story for Calvin University in Michigan that made the decision for a smaller liberal arts institution that had 65 international students that they knew weren't going to be able to make it to campus from based on where they were from. So what they did is they put together a homegrown team of professors, tutors, student life workers that could give a meaningful college experience online in that first term. What they did is they put together an 8-week program. They set up a semester, basically, beginning with the first 8 weeks, that focused on looking at the time zones. There were between 6 and 14 hours time zones, different from their campus in Grand Rapids. So it required around-the-clock work in order to make that happen. So they reacted quickly, and this isn't necessarily a pathway program, but is a way that they met a need of students that were not able to physically come to campus. So, but still giving them that kind of that first term exposure to what they needed to know about Calvin, about their education system, about their processes, about their services, that it will allow for an easier transition for those students when they finally were able to come. So in definition, pathways are now expanded to any pre-university, any time that a student spends before they physically arrive on your college campus, to include that period of time where they're being taught your programs. And that's something that is working for this institution, Calvin, in the U.S. in Michigan. But we've seen other institutions, INTED profiled a group working with CIEE offices around the world, particularly in China and other countries, where those locations, physical locations, served as classroom space for cohorts from China, from India, from other countries that could get to this facility, were able to meet each other, were able to get together, have some sort of social interaction, as well as the online piece that was taught at that facility. Others had partner universities. We've seen that with some U.S. institutions. Yale has done a program like this. Other campuses have done this in the U.S. with partner institutions overseas, where they had large cohorts, mostly in China, but some in South Korea, other countries, where those partner universities were able to host their students both physically for housing space, as well as the meeting space for the virtual student classes. So there's that pathway option that has developed, and that has been an emergent need, certainly in the last year. We see this also in Australia and New Zealand, two of the countries we mentioned earlier that have had very significant, almost total restrictions on entry into those countries. So even for students that are looking to start the new academic year in February, March in 2021, there's still the great likelihood that they will not be able to physically get to campus because of restrictions on entry. So what you've seen in Australia, the state of Victoria, has announced it's going to establish student hubs in India, Asia, and Latin America, including scholarship programs, research partnerships, and as part of their attempts as a state, the state of Victoria in Australia, to resuscitate their international ed sector. So Indian students are the second largest group of international students in Australia, and they're setting up a Study Melbourne hub in India to attract new students and to connect existing students to Victorian educational providers. So it's sort of a one-to-many, this providing a hub for international students, Indian students in particular, looking at institutions in Victoria that will open pathways for them to many different providers or institutions within Victoria that may meet the needs of those students while they start their studies online. So the Indian hub for Study Melbourne would be, a quote here from one of the providers, will provide a shared study space as well as hosting information sessions for prospective students and regular networking events such as English conversation clubs. So these are some of the short-term plans that the state of Victoria has put together to help institutions there make moves together to collectively support their educational institutions. So that's a different, very different kind of model than the Calvin model or some of the other institutions we're talking about here. Then you see something in New Zealand. The University of Auckland has announced new pathway programs that start in China and finish in New Zealand. These are not necessarily for the students that have already been admitted, but for students that might be foundation year program students that could start them in their home country, then enroll them eventually in a bachelor's degree program in New Zealand. So this is done, this University of Auckland program is done through the British pathway provider NCUK that has centers across several countries. And the first one will be launching in 2021 in China for this University of Auckland NCUK partnership. So it's a really interesting time where pandemics, disasters, major world events oftentimes force innovation. And that's what we're seeing, I think, in the last few months in higher education, certainly in the U.S., but also in other countries that rely on international education as a significant contributor to their economies, that there's been a response and there's been a time for change. And I think that's one of the beautiful things that can come out of what we're doing in international education through the pandemic is a new system, new structures, new pieces of the puzzle that will help keep us afloat, but also expand our horizons as institutions in terms of the students we're able to get in front of. So that's all we have for today on the Roundup. I want to thank you again for taking the time out, this half hour on Wednesday afternoons or whenever you're listening, to make our thoughts a part of your weekly journey. So until next time, we wish you the best of luck and a very bright 2021. Cheers.